Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Banff this afternoon. We are missing Mike Lafferty because work decided to pull him in. But we have Darren Watts with us, and he is going to be talking to us about Explorers of the Fantastic and the Sentinels of the Multiverse RPG project and just what he has going on. I'm Alice Pang, for those of you who don't know me, also Lala Twiddle on Discord and the boards. And with me also is Brandon Powers.
Howdy, howdy.
So,
and
I'm wearing my my Captain America using Thor's hammer, so it's got Watts on it.
It's random.
Mine's General Woundwork from Watership Down.
Oh, awesome!
Cool.
I love Watership Down.
Cool.
The Netflix show is enjoyable, but it did not do justice to the fantastic novel.
Right. So, please, Darren, why don't you start telling us a little bit about Explorers of the Fantastic? It sounds really cool.
It is. It's been a pile of fun so far. This kind of all started a little more than a year ago. I had just finished back-to-back projects where the Nazis were the bad guys. I had done Golden Age Champions, and then I did the Iron Sky movie role-playing game. And given, you know, kind of like the state of the world, I was complaining on social media, mostly joking, just saying, I am so sick of Nazis. Nazis aren't funny anymore. Doesn't anybody want to punch some commies? Mm-hmm. And a good dear friend of mine, Jess Nevins, who is a fabulous writer and is the creator of the Encyclopedia Victoriana and the Pulp Heroes Encyclopedia, kind of, you know, raised his hand and says, I've got a thing where we're, you know, like battling communists, you know, in the 50s. And I was like, absolutely. You know, I've wanted to work with you for 20 years. I'm delighted. Whatever it is, please tell me about it. And so he kind of pitched this project, which is refighting the Cold War with giant monsters. The third bomb that we dropped on Japan wakes up the kaiju, basically. And so history kind of goes sideways because both, you know, like the Allies and the various communist nations are kind of competing not just over nuclear weapons, that's our thing for it, but the science and, you know, what we've learned from the existence of giant monsters, basically the new physics that we all have to kind of like adapt to, because clearly the existence of these giant monsters shows that we actually don't know anything about physics. The square cube law is completely out the window. And, you know, so that we are trying to protect the world from giant monsters, but also capture them and learn from them. And so it becomes a, you know, team of action hero scientists in matching jumpsuits, working from mountain bases with cool gadgets and flying subs and that sort of thing, traveling around the world to capture and use against each other, basically, the giant monsters that keep appearing all over the place. Incidentally, it also kind of covers, I mean, you know, there are aliens invading on a regular basis. There's a hollow Earth. There's, you know, tribes of talking gorillas in Africa. There's all kind of like fabulous 50s and 60s ridiculous atomic horror that we get to kind of like throw into this.
It really sounds a little bit like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen meets Kaijus.
Yeah, a bit.
And
a bit.
And for those of you who don't
very...
know, sorry,
sorry.
For those of you who don't know, this is going to be a setting and skin for Savage Worlds engine, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Just
yeah,
want to make sure people know what it's going to be playing.
The newest edition for Savage World came out this year. Mm-hmm. The Adventure Edition, and it's fabulous. It's a thing I've spent the last few months kind of learning to use it as I'm going along, and I get fonder and fonder of it the more I'm working with it. I actually, you know, it's taken 3 or 4 months for me to feel comfortable making new stuff for it, right? I am just now thinking that I've got like enough mastery to start building my own things instead of using stuff that other people have written. So,
What is it about Savage Worlds that you really like that makes this the perfect engine for your particular setting, your particular skin?
It is both kind of, you know, like fast and pulpy action that's very, you know, easy to kind of manage at the table. But it is crunchy enough that the technology in the game actually makes a difference, right? Like you can look at the, you know, like the cool guns, that we're using as opposed to the guns that the Russians are using. And they are actually mechanically different. There's enough crunch to the system that the toy value, basically, the toy factor of all of the stuff that we're using, the vehicles and the gadgets and everything else, make a difference for it. And there really isn't, at this point, another system that's kind of like currently popular and functional for this that I think can manage both of those as well as Savage Worlds is doing right now. I didn't want this to be, you know, a story game kind of thing where characters had, you know, shooting D6 or whatever and not be able to kind of like make crunchy decisions about their gear, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So
I can completely follow that. Alice and I are both fans of systems where you get things that you can mechanically play with to represent right. things. It's, I mean, Champions is a big one for us and, you know, a lot of others. And while we can appreciate story games like Fate and that they do a good job, they, if we're going to come to the table and we're going to like put work into it, those aren't the games that we're going to say, hey, let's play this because we're going to want something.
I can play one shot.
Story games are fabulous for the kind of things that they do. I enjoy a great many of them, but I, like I said, I wanted this to have a lot of toy value to it. I wanted the props and the gadgets and everything to be significant and important in play. So,
that's awesome.
Can you tell us some of the
comfortable at the table, like, you know, pointing actual like plastic ray guns at each other, you know, kind of thing. So
I know that you're not specifically selling Savage Worlds Adventure Edition, but can you tell us some of the differences from the, I think the last one was the Explorers Edition to the Adventures Edition?
Mechanically there's not a great deal of difference. They've straightened up you know, Like many editions, it had been around for a few years and had kind of like accreted a lot of third party, you know, material. And so this is kind of the official acceptance or rejection of some of that kind of like third party material, right? It's kind of like a question of like, oh, we officially approved this. This is now, you know, formally part of the game and part of the rules. And this, you know, we have a new, you know, chase mechanic. You know, for actually kind of like resolving chases, that kind of thing. That was, you know, a thing that the Savage Worlds designers had been working on for a while. So there's not, it's going to be completely back compatible with pretty much everything if you've played in the previous editions. But it puts it all in one place very nicely. I honestly don't have that much experience with the previous one, so I don't know, you know, too much about like what the small differences in play are going to be, because I'm kind of learning it with this one.
Well, that's awesome.
But I find it tremendously, you know, satisfying to actually play. Like I said, my group has been playtesting this now for 3 or 4 months, and mm-hmm. we are enjoying it tremendously. So.
When can we expect to see more information on the internet about it? When, you know, is there a Kickstarter coming?
The Kickstarter is coming in late October. We have not set a specific date for it yet, and we are just now in the process of getting all of that set up. We're a little early for this podcast to be, you know, promoting it that much, but it will be at, the information will be at battlefieldpress.com when it comes up. Jess and I are doing it with Jonathan Thompson, who has been an enormous amount of help with us because he has a great deal of experience with Savage Worlds through multiple editions. And he has kind of kindly agreed to help us manage the Kickstarter and deal with fulfillment and that sort of thing for it, as well as serving as an editor for both for myself and Jess, who have kind of been, you know, set free to go play in this, you know, in this system. He'll be the one helping us turn it into an actual useful book that other people can function with. So.
Well, as you said, we're a little early for the promotion for this, but I believe that you have another project that you're working on that we're not a little early on. Sadly, Christopher McLaughlin couldn't join us because of technical difficulties, but I'm sure that he left in the great hands with just leaving you to talk about it.
Sure. We have, as part of the Kickstarter for the Sentinel Comics RPG coming from Greater Than Games, Christopher and I have been writing one of the kind of like core meta setting books that is the fake history of the fake comic book publisher who published all of the comics that this game is supposedly based on. And so as kind of, it serves simultaneously as a lore book for players, but also, you know, like tells the additional story of why the comics are the way they are. So it's kind of like a guide to this fake history. Christopher and I are both, amateur comic book historians. So we've managed to kind of, you know, like sneak a bunch of like true stories about ridiculous things that have happened in comic book history and managed to blame Greater Than Games for pretty much all of them. So the last quarter of the book is in fact a fake Overstreet price guide for collecting all of these fake comics, which is also your kind of like guide to the history of the universe, you know, and like the order in which things happened in, you know, in the world before we turn it over to you as the GM. Basically, this is the backstory of 80 years of history of this fake publisher. But it's all arranged as though you could in fact actually go out and pay enormous amounts of money to collect all of the, you know, special first appearances of Legacy and Wraith and all this other stuff for it. So it's been a pile of fun to write.
Yes. I didn't realize you were his writing partner for the lore of it.
Like I said, it's the lore. It kind of tells the game itself presents both the in-universe lore and the out-of-universe lore of how the universe wound up the way that it did. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who were members of what team at what time, you know, throughout history or whatever is mostly in our book. Whereas the actual kind of like core rule book for it describes the way things are the day you pick up, you know, the day you take over telling stories in the setting. Right.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I sold it to Christopher Bell, who was the publisher, at a party a couple of years ago when I told him this quick story for it. Back in the 50s and 60s, DC Comics had a bullpen the same way that Marvel did. They just didn't call it that or have, you know, make any particular deal promoting it the way that Stan did. And it was an office in Manhattan that was mostly full of kids. It was mostly full of young inkers and letterers and, you know, like the people doing the kind of the actual production work on the comics, whereas most of the freelancers were, you know, working from their homes. Mm-hmm. And there was this guy who would come in every day, and he was an older guy, big, tough-looking guy with glasses and a nose that had clearly been broken a couple of times. And, you know, and he would sit down in their break room and he would light up the biggest, filthiest cigar that, you know, like anybody had ever seen, pour himself a really strong cup of coffee, and then take the phone and the Racing Digest and spend the whole day betting on horses. And none of the kids had the guts to actually kind of like ask him, who are you and why are you in our office? Like, what's the deal? Who is this guy? So finally, one of them goes upstairs to Julie Schwartz, who was the publisher at the time, and says, you know, hey, Dave in the break room, what's the deal with him? Why does he keep coming in and smoking cigars in our break room? He doesn't seem to work here. And they said, Julie said, well, back before DC was DC Comics, back when it was National Periodicals, we published some pulp magazines, and we published some spicy pulps, and we got busted for obscenity charges. And that guy told the judge that he was the publisher, and he did 2 years in prison for us. And for the rest of his life, he had a job, you know, like a no-work showing-up job at DC for 30 or 40 years after that. Right. Now that's a true story, and I told Christopher, it's like, imagine the version of that I can tell about your company.
Yeah, that's really so cool, because the types of things, and it's really nice to know that they covered him, you know, covered his butt, so that
they took care of him. He did 2 years in prison for him, so they took care of him for 40 years.
Yeah.
So
that's really cool. But yeah, I got a little bit of a sneak peek months ago for one of the early drafts of what you guys were doing, and I thought that there was some cutesy stuff in it while I was scrolling through. But it's been quite a few months, so I don't remember all the details. But I remember going through, like in 1957, I think it was, you guys were talking about how you guys made, you know, that one of the characters was talking about making comics just for kids, and that was the audience, but there were soldiers too, and there were World War II stuff, sure. But it was just for kids. And then the back and forth between two characters there for a little bit. And it was entertaining and made me bust out laughing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are several real world histories of DC and Marvel and existing comics that kind of like tell a lot of these stories. So we're just kind of like making it, you know, a somewhat sillier version you know,
to make it a fun read.
To create this universe. But we're in a lot of cases where, you know, there'll be an appendix in the back that explains the jokes, right? That will be like, this actually happened to Stan Lee. It just happened a little differently or whatever. And it goes all the way up through to the modern day, right? Like we have the, you know, the 1-900 number Kill Robin, you know, like scandal basically, like of the 90s, of course, once again, happens to, you know, to our publisher as well, when they decide, you know, to get rid of a character by having people call in to decide whether or not he lives or dies. And it goes much worse for them than it did for DC. So
we have a lot of history in comic books these days. I mean, it's been 100 years of lots of shenanigans to put together.
Absolutely.
So
in the early days, you know, Sentinel Publishing is basically a mob front. Mm-hmm. And it's a way for the mob, the St. Louis mob, to kind of like launder their money. And the whole time we've been doing it, we would go back to the Great of the Games people and be like, is this okay? Are we allowed to like make fun of you on this level? And of course they're like, you cannot make enough fun of us. Please make it worse, you know, kind of thing. So.
Well, I'm glad that they have a sense of humor and allow you to kind of play with that. Because there are some companies that take themselves a little too seriously, and as soon as you disparage them in any way, in the most joking, lighthearted way, they want to crucify you. That's good about the company. Then again, you know, the nature of the games that they've put out, it's about making fun of the genre.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And they love, I mean, it's, you know, the reason that we were excited to get involved with it is the actual card game is such a love letter to superheroes and to superhero comics, right? Every, you know, character's cards have fake quotes from their comics at the bottom of the, you know, the bottom of the card and everything for it. Mm-hmm. And when we were looking at those as game designers and also as comic fans, we were really impressed how much it held together, right? Like it was like, these aren't random, you know, there's a world inside their heads that makes sense, that, you know, like the titles reoccur and that sort of thing for that. So you could see that it existed. And what we really wanted to do was be the writers of the official handbook to this universe, right? Mm-hmm. The same way that, you know, the Marvel official handbooks or the DC Who's Who or something, right? We wanted to create that for the fake world that they had created for the card game. And the RPG was a great excuse to actually do that. So...
Yeah, the card game, Alice and I have played it, though it's not really our game. We've got other games that we will sooner play, but we've got one set of it, and it's, I guess, the first set that they put out. And just in that, you can see the universe construction that these guys had going on, and so it was obvious that the people behind it had a large love of, you know, the comic book worlds and such like
Absolutely.
And
yeah, so the world building is tremendous in it,
so. Yeah, when I heard Christopher was in this project, you know, Alice and I have been waiting for that RPG to come out and all, and that just made us a little more interested in, you know, seeing what that book's going to look like that he's doing.
At the design of the game, the RPG itself, is also great. It's done by Cam Banks and Dave Chalker and Philippe Menard were the primary designers on it.
Is this why I haven't heard anything about Magic Vacuum, I think was the company Cam Banks got the Heroic license to?
One of the reasons, yes, absolutely.
Gotcha.
Also, Cam has moved to New Zealand, and that's kind of thrown, you know, like a wrench in the works of him getting a lot of things done. But yeah, it is, if you're familiar with Cam's work and with Dave's work, this will feel very comfortable to you. It's a brilliant piece of design, but it definitely feels like a Cam game, right? It's Marvel Heroic is clearly part of its DNA. In fact, the joke is it's a lot of the things that Marvel wouldn't let him do, you know, in Heroic, he's kind of, you know, like put into this, and it's a very strong game. It's very well put together.
Well, very
that cool. Just makes me even more excited about it, because Alice and I are big fans of the Marvel Heroic game. Played a couple sessions of it and just had a fantastic time in that one, and I know that, like, whenever somebody mentions it on the BAMP podcast, Mike's like, can we just take a moment to pour a 40 out for Marvel Heroic? And the guys there had a great time with it as well.
I totally agree with that.
The hero point economy, where you got to try and determine, you know, whether you were generating hero points and such on some of these characteristics was a great aspect.
And
there's a lot that I enjoyed. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, they're all three of them are brilliant designers. And, of course, you know, Christopher and Adam from GTG are also have also contributed to the design, because it does, if you're familiar with the card game, the mechanics of the RPG will feel comfortable to you, right? Like, it's the they work similarly. If you're used to using Legacy's deck, then playing him from his character sheet will be very easy to kind of like make the adjustment to, right? It's a combination of those aspects. So it will feel very comfortable, I think, for players who come to it, even if it's their first RPG, if they're coming to it because they love the world and they love the card game and want to see the next thing that is using those characters in that universe.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'll feel very welcomed by it, because it the adjustment will not be bumpy, you know?
Good. That sounds awesome.
Awesome.
Can you tell us a bit about the engine for that? Have you actually played it or interacted with the engine?
I've played a great deal of it. Sure. Yeah.
So,
It works. There are traits and skill that with traits and qualities. And then you have a list of your powers and a list of kind of your skills and other aspects. And each of those is represented by a die size. And then there is the status of the world, which is either how much trouble you personally are in at this point, how much damage have you taken, you know, like where are you, or how much trouble is the world around you in? And you take the worst of those. And that's also represented by a die size. And so you have three dice, and they work kind of like aspects, right, in Fate, that you kind of, you know, select which of these actually applies and build, a three die pool, basically. And then when you roll the three dice, regardless of what their sizes are, the middle number is the core mechanic that you roll, right? That's the mid. Mm-hmm. And then there is a min and max number as well. So the core conflict resolution is the mid, but superheroes use the min and max to represent other things. Right. So if you're using your power, it might be, okay, this, you know, the mid determines whether or not I hit, and the min tells me how many people I hit, or, you know, like some additional things that depending on the builds of the individual powers.
So it is very much like the old Marvel heroic. Is there still a Doom pool like mechanic?
No. Well, like I said, it that has been kind of replaced by the universe status, right?
Okay.
Like the world. The situation of any given encounter basically moves down a track from green to yellow to red
of
how dangerous everything is.
Sorry,
right?
I missed
and
that
so
earlier.
That changes the dice that actually appear in each pool. And you can, as a character, design a character who either is at their best when things are calm and, you know, can actually, like, focus on things,
mm-hmm.
or you can have a character who puts more of their points and their efforts in their build to being good when things are on the line, but maybe I'm not that effective back in the, you know, like, early stories, the early parts of the story, you know, but as the situation gets worse, I become more powerful or I become more effective. We ran the X-Men in it, and the single largest attack we built into the game for that was Storm under pressure, right? Like when, you know, she's effective and she's a useful character for most of the game, but when things actually get serious and we're in the final encounter and everything looks, you know, like at its worst, that's when she unleashes these just unholy lightning bolts and stuff that were the, you know, the largest.
Like when Doctor Doom has got her turned into a statue.
Exactly, right? So that she, of all of the characters, she was the one who was kind of like most built to be amazing in the end game, you know, kind of thing, as opposed to. So you have a lot of variability in the way that you can actually like build the characters. They also have principles that are part of the character design. And when the characters are living up to their principles, they also can get like bonuses in their whatever it is they do. So whatever, you know, kind of like role you feel like you are on the team, right, for this, if you are fit for the principle of justice, then when you are facing a situation that is clearly unjust, you know, according to the definitions of the term for it there, then you get additional dice or you get bonuses or whatever, you know, like based on it. So you have a great deal of freedom to kind of manipulate that.
I really like some of the things you're saying, because I feel like it really, while it has the core aspects of the old Marvel heroic, they definitely took it a step further and advanced it. And there are certainly aspects, because taking the do you work well, do you work best in, well, as one person or a team or duo. I think that this is what you're saying in the calm or the highest stress level is a great advancement from that. And actually, Brandon, to refer to Lexa would function best. Ella would function best at the highest stress, and at the lowest stress, she'd function the worst.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
We've seen that because when everything is hitting the fan and it's the worst possible situation, and people call liberty, she'd fly in and she'd always crit everything. But at the easiest thing, she kept sticking her foot in her mouth. So I love what you're saying because it so easily represents some of the games we've played.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It works very well. It's a lovely kind of combination because it gives you that story game level kind of narrative reaction
while
to what's happening.
Crunch.
But it's crunchy enough to be interesting, right? Like the actual mechanic of how it plays is a lot like playing the card game where you have, you know, it's like I have to, what's his name? Absolute Zero, right? Has to actually like hurt himself to get his powers actually working, right? Mm-hmm. Because in order to use his highest end ice powers, he has to kind of like open up the suit that is protecting him from the damage the environment does to him. So like, you know, it's as long as he is willing to take on damage himself, he can do an increased level of damage to everybody else. You know, that that works mechanically the same way as it does in the card game, right?
Yeah.
So it is both crunchy enough to satisfy having an interesting tactical fight while still being tied to kind of like the story game concepts of like, well, what is this story actually about, right? Like, what does my superhero actually represent as a character?
Yeah, and
so
flaws.
I think it's a nice blend of the two that you know you don't frequently see. A lot of games are stronger on one side of that than the other, and I think particular is a nice blend.
A question that I've got, since if we're looking at Marvel Heroic being in the DNA. Is there a built-in advancement, you know, in the, champions, mutants, and masterminds kind of vein where you're taking a character, gaining XP, and getting better?
Yes.
Good.
But it's not, like I said, it's a very kind of narrativist one because it's based on your comics, right? Mm-hmm. You have, as you complete stories, you have issues of your comic, right? Mm-hmm. And at any time, you can tap those and say, well, because, of what happened 3 issues ago in this, I actually see that my opponent has a weakness from where I hit her last time for this. And so I'm, you know, going to, so you can get story advancements based that like build up based on the number of comics you've actually completed. And then when you get 6 comics as a set, that becomes a graphic novel. And then the graphic novels give you larger bonuses, right? So you can tap those over the course of a story. So rather than changing the actual list of powers on your sheet for this, what you get is more abilities to give yourself bonuses.
I like that because
builds up. So the core idea of your character stays the same. It's not a question of like, oh, I spend points to get more dice. Mm-hmm. What I get is more opportunities to give myself bonuses at key times when I need to make a roll. So it's like if in Champions, if all experience points had to be spent on levels,
mm-hmm.
right? So you don't actually like change the core nature of the character. You just get better at doing the things
you
could always do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was not a fan of the switch out system in the Marvel Heroic because it made for very short campaigns or the short playability for the characters. You couldn't play them long term and really feel like there were without it being the same thing or changing at the exact same level.
Right. Well, like I said, the part of the mechanic is that you have things you can do with your powers that can be only used at certain status levels, right? Like you might have a really impressive power that can be only used when the situation is red,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when the situation is green, if you need to tap that power that you have that is listed as only usable as red, you're at a big minus to actually pull that off because we're not at that point in the story, right?
Yeah.
Those experience points make it easier. Those issues make it easier for you to tap into the stuff that you would ordinarily only be able to do late in the game anyway, right? So it does allow you to have kind of like some narrative control over what's happening in the story of, oh, even though the situation in the world may not be that bad. I need to jump to my big power because of X reason or whatever for that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what my experience is for. That's what will allow me to do that as I get better as a character. So
that's cool. A cool mechanic, by all means.
I look forward to playing it. I'm excited to play it.
Well, it'll be coming out relatively shortly. Like I said, the Kickstarter went off in March, I think, was when it actually finished.
Sounds right.
And so, people have been working around the clock for it. I keep getting the frustrating, it's not really frustrating, it was I knew going in on the job, but they have been finishing, the core mechanics have been out there for a while. The Quick Start came out almost 2 years ago. So you
guys I've seen that, but I didn't want to buy a Quick Start and then not have a game to follow
up. Exactly. Well, and the Quick Start doesn't have, character builds information or anything in it. It just gives you some existing characters.
Quick Starts tend to be a little disappointing for a lot of games, so we didn't want to have a negative impression from the get-go.
Sure, fair enough. But the mechanic has been done that long, right? Like the rules mechanics for it. So what they have been doing is spending a great deal of time both on the details of, character design and all that stuff, but also getting the universe right. And the universe obviously went through a big change. The last edition of the card game blew up the multiverse, right? I mean, that was the Oblivion event, basically, mm-hmm. is their equivalent of the Crisis or that sort of thing, right? So the universe has changed. And so every time some new detail was worked out on their end, Professor and I had to go back and rewrite our stuff to match it, right? So that's like our book has been like 90% done for months, waiting for kind of like the final things to be sealed off of like, what exactly is the situation with Legacy and his daughter now? Well, we're still writing that. Okay, well, I'll just leave that as a blank in my book, kind of thing until you guys
give
make up your mind.
Give us the information we need. Mm-hmm.
So the core of the game is done. It's all the squiddly little bits about the universe that are kind of like the last thing to go. And of course, they're super perfectionists and it's taking forever for them to actually get that done. But the moment they're done, the moment they close the books on theirs, ours should be right behind it because we have a largely finished manuscript with these various little holes in it waiting to be filled in. So.
Well, and I think from a company standpoint, they're kind of in a unique way is that they have, like we talked about, they built a universe, and they have fans of that universe. Forget about the card game. I mean, these people like the card game and all, but they like that universe.
Yeah.
And so unlike Marvel and DC, where you have these real issues that, really have determined, a lot of that is, hinted at, or, this box is about this, this crossover event. And so they're trying to, construct, and obviously you're part of that, that full history of it, people are invested in that already, and that's
they are marvelously nuts. And believe me, I know from crazy fan bases, right? I mean, it's I had Hero myself for many years, and I've worked on Star Trek and Doctor Who. I know what crazy fan bases are like, mm-hmm. and these guys are gloriously crazy. We actually, when we sat down to kind of straighten out their universe and kind of like figure out this history, we were keeping a list of all of the no prize mistakes that they had made up to that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
The character Tachyon exists in their universe before the word Tachyon was invented for the particle. So
that's
the
speedster, right?
Yeah.
Well, clearly there was a multidimensional mind, a hive mind kind of thing going on there.
Clearly, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who named the Tachyon named it after the character,
mm-hmm.
right? That was our solution for that. That's our no prize answer, is that he was just a big fan of the comic, and therefore, when this, faster-than-light particle was discovered, we'll name it after my favorite comic book character. So we've had to go back. There's a bunch of, those kind of things, which we call, after the sentence, their magical xylophone, right? anything that they've gotten wrong. When Arthur Clarke says that sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, he's actually quoting Baron Blade, because in the comic line, he said that first. So, there's a bunch of stuff like that we've had to just kind of like hand wave and say, it's like, well, whatever. Turns out that's wrong, but who knew? So nobody looked it up when we wrote it. So
there you go. I I think those are great solutions.
It feels very organic, right? It feels like the kind of dumb mistake that Marvel would have made at some point or something. So we've left it all in, you know. So.
Very cool. Well, it sounds like that's a project that you're very passionate about. But
sure.
And we put a lot of time into that. But why don't we go back to Explorers of the Fantastic a little bit more?
Okay, nope.
Brandon, I think
you have a question. So I had a question. You talked about the kaiju coming out and such. And so is that like something that in a boss fight encounter that the party are actually expected to be fighting a kaiju? Or is that something that is more moving at the speed of plot kind of thing?
It depends on how you play it. We're kind of like leaving in the option to do it several different ways. In a Godzilla movie, what the humans tend to be up to kind of like happens on the side while the giant monster battles are happening, right? Mm-hmm. Godzilla rampaging across the Tokyo, skyline or whatever. That's kind of like weather, right? That's just what's happening while the humans are up to something that's happening at their scale, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can certainly play it as, like the giant monsters are the actual opponents and you've got high tech, gear and equipment and everything, and you're trying to find their weaknesses and battle them individually, or they can be just kind of like a feature of the setting. And the interesting thing is the knowledge that we're getting from their existence, right? If you look at Destroy All Monsters, just as an example movie for it, aliens have come to Earth and they have taken all of the giant monsters and mind controlled them and set them loose on the world. And the heroes have to fight the aliens, not the giant monsters, right? They have to eventually, find the facility on the moon that's actually like mentally controlling them. And then they take control of that facility and then suddenly they're piloting the giant monsters around, right? And then so now that becomes like the cool thing that the heroes are into. Or, we're in a race with our opposite number agency of human level agents who one of us is going to get control over this monster on some level. That being said, sorry.
Oh, I thought you were pausing. I apologize. Please finish.
Yeah, just that being said, it's not really fun to have a giant monster game where you can't be the giant monster. Mm-hmm. So you can also play it on that level where, at some point you're playing the PCs who are doing their human level scale of what's going on, but we're going to have rules so that giant monsters can fight each other. For that, and those can be taken over by the characters at the table as well. So there's no, I'm missing out the fun part of what's going on. No, you'll also get to like play a monster and, smash a city and knock some buildings over just as part of what's happening. But that's not really the core of the game. That's just a fun thing that you do on the side, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when you were talking about that, I thought, well, the heroes can also take over an alien spaceship and then go fight the kaiju in it.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And giant monsters are not the only things that we're fighting. They're just kind of like the key event that changes the world. Mm-hmm. With the science that we get now from understanding them, we're also fighting alien invasions and we're exploring the Hollow Earth and we're traveling to, like the depths of Africa and finding tribes of intelligent gorillas. Anything that might happen in a crazy 50s or 60s, like atomic horror level, movie or TV show or anything. You can play Johnny Quest in this. You can play, Thunderbirds or Go, you can play any kind of like 50s or 60s story where action scientists are the heroes, basically.
And League of Extraordinary whatever they might be. Like we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So any set of 50s or 60s heroes, like we're all wearing matching color-coded jumpsuits and we have, the electro pistols and flying submarines and all kind of other stuff. There's all kinds of adventures that you can get into that don't necessarily have a giant monster in them at all. Mm-hmm. But the reason we have cool flying subs is because of technology and science that we got from studying giant monsters. So that's kind of like a background of the setting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doomtown was Deadlands was totally changed by the discovery of Ghost Rock. Not necessarily everything follows right. Ghost Rock in the story, sure. But that was the catalytic event. So are kaiju like ninjas that the fewer that are around, the more dangerous? But if you get like a
yes.
pack of
yes, they are.
Awesome kaiju, absolutely. Then they become weaker?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, it's because they're
down. We've been having a kind of a film festival of them recently for it, and my wife has now discovered that Anguirus is her favorite kaiju because he never wins a fight. He's like 0-4 30 or 40. He's just the guy like Worf that you send out there to get his butt kicked so that you can see how tough the actual new bad monster is.
Uh-huh.
So he's like Godzilla's best friend and keeps showing up, and he's right there beside him, and then he goes out to fight the bad guy and just gets clobbered in the first scene, right? Kind of before. So of course she has now like fallen in love with this character and has like adopted him for it. So yeah, we're trying to make them all of the fictional ones that we'll create, we hope to make them as interesting and easy to tell apart, you know, as kind of like the great kaiju of Japanese films have been, right? And it is a great sorrow to us that Anguirus is not in the most recent Godzilla, you know, all monsters, the last one that just came out for it, that they didn't actually get the rights to him. We only got the four that they did, so...
Rights are a very funny thing, as you know, Sony versus Disney going on right now.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, and you're just like, they're all Marvel. Why can't we just get them all together?
Let's go back in time 30 years and stop Marvel from selling stuff off to Sony in the first place. You can do that. But
so, in the Canadian wilderness, is there a Weapon K program?
Not yet, but there might be. One would fit pretty well, I think, for it. Sure.
Well, very cool.
But like I said, you can play it with either play it as a fairly serious. I mean, we're going to include, you know, like the alternate history that was created by this. We play tested an adventure a couple of weeks ago where the heroes had been invited by a Tibetan monastery to come look at their Yeti stuff. Right, like they had like a scalp and a claw and a bunch of other stuff and some fur from Yetis in their monastery, and so they were inviting the scientists to actually come look at it. And the twist of the story was that one of the people who wanted to come along on this expedition to Tibet was a CIA agent who was having a secret meeting with the Dalai Lama when he was 15 to see if he would be willing to be part of a CIA-backed rebellion against China. Mm-hmm. So you can play this as a fairly serious kind of like political game of retelling the stories of the Cold War and take that all very dead seriously. Or you can play it on the level of commies are just cartoon bad guys who need to be punched while we're dealing with monsters. And, you know, hopefully the game will work at whatever level of kind of seriousness that you take the background. We want to make it adaptable to play it, to be played the way you want to play it. Mm-hmm. You know,
is the game is specifically set in 1950s, 60s, or do you guys have kind of how things go from there?
What we are right now, what all we have is the 50s and 60s. We hope that it is successful enough that people will want to come along, buy enough of these to make it worth our time to make more supplements. Also, the stretch goals for the Kickstarter will include several other writer friends of ours, and some of their material might actually kind of like take the same basic setting idea and expand it into either previously to the public awareness of kaiju, or take it further into the future, into the 70s, 80s, to the modern day, or what. But the core game that Jess and I are writing is specifically in the 50s and 60s.
Very cool.
Gotcha. And, I'm certain it's beyond the scope of what you guys are looking at, but, kaiju miniatures, I'm blown away that, you know, I mean, we get all these dragons or dinosaurs and such, but Reaper and the other companies, I don't see kaiju coming out from them, specifically.
I have no artistic skill to actually, like, make that, but if this takes off, I am 100% behind you getting it licensed somewhere, so...
So
we're designing a bunch of cool kaiju, and I would love to turn that over to somebody with actual sculpting talent. So,
in the book, how many kaiju are we looking at that you guys already have pre-statted up, and do we have a creation set for us to come up with our own wacky kaiju?
We will have a creation set, yes. I do not know the number of them that we will actually wind up with because we're still in the process of writing it. I'm going to guess 8 or 10, you know, something to give kind of like a representative spread of different types, basically, and how you might use them, you know. And you want to scale them right, too, right? I mean, there's, you know, kind of like the giant monsters that you face in a, you know, 50s American monster movie, like the giant Gila monster or something like that, obviously is not built at the same scale as like the, you know, 500 foot tall Godzilla, you know, like at his actual like size peak, right? So we want to have a spread depending on the level of where you want the menace to be at, right? You know, like exactly the first game of this that we ever ran, they were facing a giant snapping turtle and they beat it by driving a boat full of explosives into its mouth, which is a perfectly good way to defeat a monster in a certain kind of monster movie in the 50s, but that's not going to work on Godzilla, right? Mm-hmm, that's just, right. You know, Godzilla will just chow down on that and keep going, and, you know, it might give him a little indigestion or something, but he's just going to keep smashing Tokyo, right? So, I mean, there's scale is a big part of the game. It's a big part of the interest in kaiju. And so we want the game to work at multiple different scales.
Is there any mechanic that you guys have to help enforce the like difference between scales?
We're in the process of working on that. Savage Worlds has an existing mechanic of heavy weaponry, right? Where it's like you have armor and you know, vehicles and that sort of thing that can only be affected by weapons that deal out a certain kind of damage, right? That stops you from accidentally rolling really well and, you know, stopping a tank with a sword or something like that, right? And so mechanically, we are working on kind of like the next step up from that, because we don't want a tank to get an accidental lucky shot on Godzilla and take him out accidentally just by rolling really, right? Like a tank should never, no matter what it does, your best shot from a tank should never do anything more than distract Godzilla, right? So we're working on the mechanic of kind of like taking the heavy weaponry concept up another notch to the super heavy weaponry or something, whatever. We haven't decided on the name yet.
If you need playtesters, you have two volunteers right here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right now I have two groups actually currently running it that I'm still, it is not in a state yet that it can be run without one of us in the room.
Well, awesome.
When it gets to that point, we have to like turn it over to other people, right? We have to then, you know, at some point this game has to stand on its own.
Right.
You can't sell a copy of me and, you know, Professor with every game. So, but we're not at that point yet. When we get to that point, I'd be delighted to send you guys a copy and let you play it at home and see.
Awesome.
See what you think of it. So.
Well, we'd also love to have you on for actual play demos and such like that on BWK, as we've talked about. So.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. No, that sounds like fun.
Do you guys have Clifford the Big Red Dog as one of your kaiju in those 8 to 10?
Yeah, not yet.
You know, I mean, the friendly neighborhood kaiju.
He's he'd be a PC, right? He's a good guy.
Yeah. I would love Clifford the Big Red Dog as a kaiju.
You could very easily make him with the rule set that we got, so.
Awesome.
And
he like
so
changes
like,
size a lot too, right? Like sometimes he's only like big enough to like fill the living room, and sometimes he's like bigger than your whole house.
Yep.
Yeah.
The art always kind of like always seems to be, you know, uncertain exactly how big he is.
Yep.
And so in for PCs, I mean, you've talked about some things that I absolutely love: intelligent gorillas. I didn't read comics back when those were huge, but I just love the concept. And I actually just read an X-Men First Class issue where they brought Gorilla Man in, and I was like, "Oh, this is awesome! I love this." But can you make PCs out of the intelligent gorilla while the other part of the team is playing the guys in the suits?
100%,
and can you
yes.
have some of the smaller end kaiju that might be working with the heroes?
We don't have a kaiju in the NPC collection, but we do have a talking gorilla in the NPC collection. And we've got one of the NPCs has a pet saber-toothed tiger that they brought back with them from the Hollow Earth, which is of course all full of dinosaurs and stuff. As far as actually like playing a tiny kaiju, I'm sure you could work it out. There isn't one, you know, like I said in the sample stuff yet, but the kaiju who are, you know, our NPC kaiju basically for it are of wildly shifting alliances, right? I mean, like at any given time, Godzilla may be a good guy or a bad guy, depending on what you need him to be for the story, right? But
it all depends on whose city he's stomping on.
It depends on whose city, and it depends on like what else is in the story, right? I mean, if there's something worse than Godzilla out there, we wind up rooting for Godzilla. But on the other hand, Mothra is pretty much good all the time, right? I don't think there's ever been a version of Mothra where we were concerned that she was actually destroying things and killing people, right? So, I mean, that's, you know. And then Rodan, hilariously, changes sides all the time, depending on who seems to be winning. which is kind of like one of the most amusing characteristic about him is that you can't trust him at all. He'll totally betray you.
Is the Loch Ness Monster in there?
Not yet, but probably will be before we're done.
Cool.
So.
Well, that's awesome.
So, I have a question. Have you ever watched the definitive Godzilla battle of Bambi meets Godzilla?
Yes, I have. Absolutely.
Okay, good.
No, I've been a huge Godzilla fan all my life. I've been a, you know, Saturday afternoon movie, you know, watcher since I was a little kid for it. In fact, that's also where I was introduced to Mexican wrestling, because where I grew up in with the Boston TV stations, they used to mix El Santo movies in with the Godzilla and Gamera movie. And my whole life, I thought that was the case for everybody. So I was very startled to like move away and go to California and be like, how have you never seen an El Santo movie? They're on all the time. Well, that's not the case, except in Boston, apparently, so.
Awesome. Well, you've answered all my questions. I'm looking forward to this. I definitely want to try it and give Savage Worlds another go.
Excellent.
With this
Excellent.
One.
Well, like I said, if we're going to do an actual play thing for babies, then we can quickly walk through how that's going to work. So.
Awesome. Well, yay. I'm excited about playing and seeing more of Explorers of the Fantastic coming soon.
Like I said, Kickstarter hopefully in late October by Darren Watts, Jess Nevins, and Jonathan Thompson.
Awesome.
As the primary creators. And hopefully, once again, one of the things we're working on this week and the next couple is getting a really cool roster of stretch goal writers to actually participate in this. So the bigger the support we get, the more awesome writers that we're going to have involved in. So.
Well, then let's get hyping.
Absolutely.
Anything else anybody wants to add, or should I close this out?
One quick question, actually. Is Explorers of the Fantastic supposed to specifically like riff on Challengers of the Unknown kind of naming convention?
Absolutely, one of the key pieces of its DNA for this. Like I said, it's Godzilla movies, it's Challengers of the Unknown, and every other 50s action scientist comic, right? It's not just Challengers, but the Sea Devils and Cape Carson and all of those guys. It's Johnny Quest to a certain extent. It's the Super Mario Nation TV shows from England, right? It's Thunderbirds Are Go and Stingray and all that kind of thing. With giant monsters as the primary antagonists, but certainly not the only one.
So. All stuff I haven't watched since I was very young.
Well, bring it back because it's cool.
Yep.
I've been wondering during this entire conversation where the cartoon for Explorers of the Fantastic was when I was growing up, you know?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Actually, in setting, there is, in fact, actually a TV show based on the adventures of the real-world scientists doing this, so.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Did you have anything else you wanted to ask, Darren?
I think I'm covered.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
Oh, not at all. Thanks for having me on. I love you guys.
Thank you very, very much for joining us. And thank you all for watching Banff, either watched it live or watching the recording later. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Bye.
See ya.
Adios.